Okay, what's up, everybody? Bill Doyle, Culture Mashup, the art and culture show bringing it back to the people, coming to you out of Sacramento, California. Our guest today is Mike Blanchard, journalist, musician, photographer, and publisher. And that's a mouthful. Mike, welcome to Culture Mashup. And did I miss anything?
No, I mean, yeah. Hello, everyone.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're happy to have you. Let me just say, too, I know Mike personally. We met about, I want to say, 4 years ago when I had a K100 RS BMW motorcycle, and I did something bad to the driveline and searched all over this great city of Sacramento and region, and nobody would touch it, other than, I will say, Dennis over at Vintage Monkeys, but it was about a 9 to 10 month wait.
Dennis is very busy.
Yes, great shop, very busy. Mike was kind enough to take it in. Turned out we had some common interests and we've stayed friends. Can't say the same for the bike. We had to part ways in the Beamer. So, Mike, you have a lot of creative endeavors, or we have to start somewhere. Let's talk about journalism. Do you remember your first story?
My first story? Mm-hmm. Actually, I do. When I was just out of high school, I lived in Carmel. And I was doing work for Monterey Life magazine, and I was doing work for the magazine from the Pacific Grove Art Center, and writing articles on different artists. Probably the most notable was an interview that I did with Brett Weston, who's an extremely famous West Coast photographer, the son of Edward Weston, who's one of the most famous West Coast art photographers. Mm-hmm. We did it at his home in Carmel Valley. And it was fascinating. It was notable for me because I took my old Rolleiflex camera, which when I went to go shoot the photos, broke. And the film transport broke, and I had to just guess at where the frames were to shoot it, and but it came out good.
Okay.
The article came out good. He made some statements about his brother, which I understand caused quite a stir within that particular world. But
that was your first outing as a journalist.
Yeah, it was one of the first, one of the first two or three.
Right. That's quite a start.
Yeah, yeah. And then I went, shortly after that, I moved to Sacramento to go to college at Sac State and work on my journalism degree. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, at that point, you end up writing a lot.
Right.
So,
what got you interested in writing? I mean, were you always a curious kid, jotting things down?
I was more interested in photography. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in photography, but it was easier to sell photographs to these magazines if I could write the article to go with the photographs.
Right.
It's just more, you know, the journalism world is known for its penny pinching.
No.
More so these days than it used to be, but mm-hmm. at the time it was a lot easier to get work if I would shoot the photos and write the article.
Right.
And so, and I knew, I knew who Brett Weston was and studied his history and studied his father, and one of his younger brothers was one of my dad's friends. So it just worked out that it was a shoe-in for me to do it.
Okay. So how'd the photos turn out?
Photos came out great. I wish I could find the negatives. I can't find the negatives anymore.
Right.
I lost over the years. I've lost a lot of my negatives. There was a big flood in, I want to say, would have been 87, 88, something like that around here. And at the time I lived in a house on 8th Street, had a big basement, and all my records and a lot of my negatives and stuff were in the basement, and the basement flooded. So I lost a lot of things in that particular flood. But anyway, you know, time moves on. I have a copy of the magazine, so I have the article, and
that's fantastic.
So
did you ever go the more traditional route or think about it like television, ad copy, you know, kind of the more corporate?
No, I never got into it. I got into playing music in the 80s and sort of went in a different direction. I don't know if at this point, I don't know, you know, I kind of wish I'd gone just and stayed with the journalism. I at the time, in about 85, I went to work for Thrasher Skateboard Magazine. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a lot of stories for them and shot a lot of photos. And that was a really wild experience. It was like being on tour with a rock band. I saw a lot of really crazy things. Uh-huh. And did a lot of really crazy things. I mean, young men and, you know, various things that young men do.
Yes. I was a big fan of Thrasher. I work for Transworld.
Okay.
So I'm familiar with that.
I did some work for Transworld, but I mm-hmm. always had to do it under a different name.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Slight conflict of interest there.
It was mostly advertising stuff.
Sure.
But Thrasher Skateboard Magazine, the guys that owned Thrasher owned Independent Trucks. So mm-hmm. I had friends that rode for Tracker Trucks, had sponsorship with Tracker Trucks. So if I shot ads for Tracker Trucks, I had to do them under a different name. Otherwise, the guys that I work for would be really mad.
Right. It's now what the Hollywood producers do when they do adult films. You know, and they have to make a little extra bread on the side.
I have no experience with that, so I don't know. So. I've been invited to do that, but right. demurred.
Yes, that's we'll put that in the
back.
Yeah,
there's
a lot of money in it. So, anything you really prefer to write about or not write about?
No, I publish a magazine called Rust, which is what's generally known as a men's general interest magazine, which means what I'm generally interested in.
Right.
I'm sure there were things when I was in journalism school that I had to go write about that were not my favorite things to write. I'm not huge on man on the street things. If I had more experience at it, I would probably be more comfortable with it.
That's one of Surfer Magazine's bread and butters, you know, for years, was the man on the street.
Well, that's a little bit different. I mean, you're going to talk with your crowd, your people.
Right.
That's a little bit different than just cold calling people on the street and asking them, you know, what do you think about Joe Biden and the Democrats' chances in the midterms?
Right.
You know, that's a whole other thing.
It can get ugly.
It could possibly, potentially.
On that, what do you think of the current state of news media outlets? Because to me, it feels like the turn of the century in yellow journalism. Nothing is too crazy. No fact checking whatsoever. You know, if you heard it at a party, you can blurt it out in an article, a tweet, and nobody seems to care about the accuracy. I find it a little odd being an older guy remembering some of the rules of journalism.
Well, I mean, journalism is in a state of massive flux. There's so many things coming into play. I mean, you have social media in which there is zero fact checking or very, very little. I mean, I'm sure there are some news outlets, online platforms, things like that. I'm sure the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal's platforms are fairly well fact checked, but there are so many things that are completely, it's just the Wild West and people can say anything. And, you know, the public has turned away from traditional journalism, and traditional journalism is in a spot anyway because their normal revenue sources have been lost, and they were getting a little arrogant, more than a little in some respects. So, you know, it's a state of great flux because you know, most of what you see on a lot of what you see is, it's not journalism, it's entertainment. It's billed as journalism, but it's not entertainment. Fox News is not news. Right. They're entertainment.
Right. Or BuzzFeed.
Yeah. Or BuzzFeed, right, or those things. I don't pay much attention to that kind of stuff. If I'm going to research something, I'm going to really try to stick to reliable sources. And as much as people talk down about traditional news outlets, you know, a company like the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times or, you know, even the Washington Post and various things like that, they actually are rigorously fact checked.
Right.
But I mean, every once in a while something slips through, and that's the nature of people. You know, mistakes will happen. But you know, I'm more of a magazine guy and have always been more of a magazine guy than a newspaper guy. I'm a little more of a hothead and probably couldn't get away with some of the standards that rigorous newspaper journalism requires.
Right.
I have done video and written videos and produced shows and things like that, but that's a whole other thing.
I heard you can be a hothead in television.
I guess you can be a hothead in television.
You can be a lot of things in film and television. You get away with it
a lot
for years.
That's
what I've seen. It's not a great thing.
It's not the world of Walter Cronkite anymore.
No, it is not.
It's a whole different thing. I've been much more interested in magazine. I like long form journalism. I enjoy that.
So narrow and deep as far as a focus.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Narrowish.
I have written a lot of little short news blurb things about car wrecks and different things like that, just for various reasons occasionally. And it's not that hard to write. There are some rules to it that are pretty easy to, once you know what the style and the form is, it's pretty easy to bang out if you're any kind of writer.
Right.
But I've written everything from screenplays and short stories to all different kinds of things. So I like writing. I like telling a story. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you have a good idea and you can write clearly.
Right.
It's really not that hard. When I get people to write stories for me, every once in a while I'll find somebody that is an expert in their field and I try to get them to write a story for me. And oftentimes people are uncomfortable writing, and usually what I tell people is if you and I were sitting at a bar next to each other and you were telling me about this great thing that you just saw, just write it like that,
right?
And it'll probably be pretty coherent, and if it isn't, between myself and my copy editor we can straighten everything out. And
right. Conversational tone is what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, it's just an easy way for people to get into writing something, especially if they're going to tell a story. You know, I got interested in whiskey, and right. I tried to get a friend of mine who's a huge whiskey freak to because I didn't understand, like, what's the difference between rye and Canadian whiskey and right. Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey and bourbon. And, you know, if you ask a bartender, most bartenders can't tell you anything about that.
No, they cannot.
But I have a friend who's a huge collector of Irish whiskeys, and so I got him to write me a story. We went to Ireland one year, and I got him to write me a story about Irish whiskey and the history of Irish whiskey and the history of whiskey. And it was basically, you know, we had to have this talk about, well, how do you write these things? And it's right. basically, let's just be conversational, do some research, find out what you can, you know, tell the story from, you know, it starts here, it ends there. We'll straighten it out.
Right. I think, I was a public relations major. It was something like, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you just told them.
Yeah, it's almost that way. There are various styles of writing. Mm-hmm. You know,
of course.
If you go to college or even in high school, you learn these things. How do you write an essay? How do you write a resume? How do you write? Well, there's styles. So that's an academic way of writing things is to, you know, state your theory, make your case, and then state your theory again at the end and say whether you proved it or not.
And make it interesting.
And try and make it interesting.
Yep. Yep.
In journalism, there's various styles. Newspaper style is you front load everything into the first paragraph. You try to put as absolutely much information in the first paragraph as you can, because most people don't read all the way to the end of a story. Oftentimes you'll see stories just end in weird, abrupt ways. Mm-hmm. And it's because the layout guy didn't have room, so he cut the last three paragraphs off of it.
Right.
But magazine writing is a little bit different. It can be more in depth. You can start out in a more creative way. There are just different ways of telling, just different styles of telling the story.
Speaking of whiskey, I got into it myself, and like yourself, I don't know much about it. I know I like to drink whiskey. what I do, you know, I'm terrible. You know, I comb various magazines. You know, I look online at whiskey magazines, fashion magazines, whatever whiskey they happen to mention that's semi within my budget. I go out and buy a bottle, taste it. You know, it works for me. My wife used to be a bartender. She's actually pretty skilled in the art of alcohol, I guess. You know, particularly wine. She worked at a French restaurant, worked at bars before she went back to school. She knows a lot better, you know, or should I say a lot more than I do. But I like the whiskey. It's gotten a little crazy. It is quite the trend.
It has been. Well, I guess it always has been. I'm not a huge whiskey drinker. I just got curious about it sitting at the bar one afternoon, looking at all the various bottles, and I had asked the bartender, hey, like, hey, what's the difference between rye and the guy had no idea whatsoever, and I just thought, well, that's kind of unprofessional.
Just got to wing it, right?
Let me see what I can find out. And it actually took me a little while to find somebody that would research it. And I, you know, you look online, you do some stuff like that. You kind of look around a little bit. But, you know, there are people that are super, super into it. And there's some people like Patrick at Father Patty's in Woodland, who's got an amazing whiskey vault, and just various friends. And I've just... It's some people, if you study history, the story of beverages like beer or wine or distilled spirits are in some ways the story of civilization, because when people started growing things,
right,
you have to do something with that wheat or that whatever it is, right, and otherwise it can go bad, or there's different ways. So it parallels the history of civilization. Alcoholic beverages of various sorts parallel the history of civilization. And so, you know, these things are all just really fascinating to me.
Right.
And they run as a, you know, as a thread throughout history or literature or all these things. So if you're a curious person, you'll find yourself wondering, like, I wonder what the deal is with that.
And then jumping down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you try and figure out, like, well, why?
Which makes me want to ask you, I read somewhere that you finished your degree, actually recently, right? Last few years, you ended up knocking the degree out. Is that true?
Yeah, actually about 8-9 years ago. Yeah, I went to college in the 80s, and stupidly, because my parents were willing to pay for it, I split early because I got a job working for Thrasher Magazine, and I figured, well, why do I need to study this when I can just go do it?
Ah, and there's my question. With some of the things we've talked about now, about all the different online outlets. I mean, right, you can blog for a couple bucks a month. You can get your own website. There's so many different outlets right now. Why'd you feel the need to get a degree?
Well, I'm officially the least educated in my family. My mother has a PhD. My brother has a PhD. My dad and my sister both have masters.
It's a lot to live up to.
So I just, it was just a personal goal. I wanted to do it, and I wanted to be an example for my boys. I went back in my 50s and did it, and it was much better. You know, when you're a little bit older, you have a little more perspective on how hard things are. I would laugh because I would hear people in my classes, young people, say, like, I can't do math, it's hard. And I'm like, no, pulling the tranny out of a truck is hard. This is easy. All you got to do is do your homework,
right,
and do the work, and you'll be fine. And so many younger people that I saw try and talk themselves out of being able to do things without ever really giving it an effort. So anyway, I really enjoyed going back to school. I really enjoy the collegiate college environment. I enjoy learning. I'm a big reader and collector of books. So, you know, I really enjoyed it, and I did really well. I feel somewhat embarrassed that I did so badly in the 80s when, you know, I was mostly just chasing girls around and messing around.
I mean, everybody's college experience is different. I worked like 40, 50 hours a week through school. I hated it. I mean, I loved being in school, but overall, you know, I couldn't wait to get out because... You know, between the actual school, I was active in a lot of extracurriculars, and then working didn't leave a lot of free time. But with that said, I went back to school just for fun during the pandemic, like so many people. I went to Foothill, where I went to JC before I went to San Jose State. And like you, I loved being an old guy in school because I got to really enjoy and was really interested in the classes I took.
Way more... you have much better perspective, mm-hmm, and much better ability to apply yourself. And, you know, I just really, really enjoyed it. You know, I sometimes think if I could get a job working on campus someplace, right, I would just do it. And just to be on campus, I thought it was, I really enjoyed it. If it wasn't for the fact that however many years it took me to get everything straightened out, and plus I was paying for it myself. I'd paid off my student loans, and then I was just paying for each semester out of my pocket, but I had to go back to work. I would have loved to gone on and got my master's. And in fact, most of my professors and advisors were like, okay, so what's going to be, let's get you going on your master's, you know.
Right.
But the state university system has a really good program for people that are 65 or older. It's very cheap to go back to school, and I'll probably do something like that in a few years.
Right.
So
there's some pretty good online, like reputable online schools. So I do classes through EDX. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but
I have never heard of them.
It's a mixture of universities around the world. So I've done some multimedia classes, film classes. My youngest son wants to actually take a video game programming class.
Nice.
But they're legit, you know, actual accredited colleges, and they have a lot of master's programs that are at your own pace. So I've actually considered, you know, like maybe setting a 7 to 10 year goal of getting a master's degree, taking, you know, a class or two a year. And it's affordable. That's also the nice thing. You can audit for free and or pay for the accreditation.
Yeah, college is ridiculously expensive. It was one of the great tragedies of the Ronald Reagan era in California, you know, before Reagan was governor. It was very, very inexpensive to go to college in California, something on the order of $150 a semester to go to go to Berkeley or
yes, it was.
To go to, you know, wherever. And Reagan and the right wing was out incensed at the student activism movement at Berkeley and worked really hard to undermine Clark Kerr and to put the clamp on college, and very specifically to make college unaffordable for people from lower class people, and specifically to make college more conservative. And it didn't really work in that respect, although it drove college prices astronomically. But it was one of the great tragedies of the Ronald Reagan governor. Of California.
I agree.
Because if you look at the fact that it was so affordable for Californians to get a college degree, you know, California, it's very famously said California is like the fourth or fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. Well, why is that? Because we had an education system that we had a much more educated populace in California who built businesses, who did amazing things. They invented amazing things. They built amazing businesses. And that's why we had this, why we have this huge economic growth in California that we're still benefiting from, but we would benefit more from, even more, if college was affordable.
Right. It's pretty, I mean, I think when I went to Foothill in the 80s, it was, I mean, it was like $65 a quarter or something. And when I went to San Jose State in the 90s, you know, starting, I think, in 1990, it was about $300 something. I think it got to four when I graduated, which at that time, it was not a lot of money. It's totally doable. And now it is, state college is expensive.
It's expensive. You can go to a junior college very inexpensively, but I mean, California State University system is up to almost $3,000 a semester for undergraduate semesters.
Right. Plus books, materials.
Plus the books, plus, and that's a whole nother scammy scam thing that's just ridiculous.
Yes,
you know, why there would ever be a new algebra book is beyond me. Algebra has not changed for however many thousand years.
Yeah, the books always
kill. It's just ridiculous.
They did. But let's shift gears here. Let's talk about Rust Magazine. Again, a lot of things going on with Rust. We've got cars, motorcycles, fashion, photography, and a smattering of other things. Like I just read the article on the mountain biker.
Oh, yeah.
So is that the gist of it? I mean, what else am I missing there?
Well, there's art and books. Okay. There's video stuff.
Right.
There's just all different kinds of things. It's, as I said before, it's mostly what I'm different things that I'm interested in. If somebody has something interesting, I'm interested in it. I haven't been working at it as diligently in the last few years as I have at various points, but I'm always working on it. I'm doing an article right now on a mountain bike event that I did a couple weeks ago. So I'm working on that.
You did that Dynamite motorcycle gathering up in Portland recently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The One Moto Show, which is fantastic. It's what a great event, and they're really generous to me. They always invite me to come, and it's just an amazing event. I love Portland to begin with, but yeah, it's fantastic. It's one of the top five motorcycle events in the country. But it's just I started it we started it, my wife mm-hmm. and I and my friend Brad and my friend Dean was involved in the early days of it, and Jerry Brad. Perry.
Didn't Brad work at the motorcycle shop with you?
No.
Is that a different Brad? Wasn't there a Brad there?
No.
No?
No, mm-hmm. no, just some friends of mine, and we were sitting around having a beer and talking, just telling stories to each other. My wife was like, my wife had been in advertising, magazine advertising sales, and she was like, why don't you guys just make a magazine about this? Because at the time, I didn't like any of the weeklies. I never liked Sacramento News and Review. It didn't have articles that were of interest to me.
Right.
So anyway, we just started this magazine as a print magazine in 2002, and we did it for about 6 years. And it did very well. We had 10,000 subscribers.
Wow.
All over the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it did very well, and we didn't lose money on it. We did well, but I had to stop doing it for more personal reasons, but I didn't really want to. But it was dormant for a little while, and then in late 2016, early 2017, my friend Soroyan, who was our designer at the time, we started talking about reviving it as an online magazine, which we did in, I want to say, May or April in 2017. And our first big event was we went to Bonneville in 2017.
Oh, wow.
So we got it up and flying. It's online at russmag.com. Mm-hmm. It'll pull up on your phone or on your computer. And there's just a huge wealth of, just a really deep well of articles and different things. Some things long form, some things short form, photo layouts. There's some video, there's book reviews, gear, art. There's a whole big section on art. There's some fantastic artists in there. We've done fashion, we've done all different kinds of things. You know, all of these things are central to sort of what we do.
Right. There's a lot going on there. You know, it's funny though, I was looking at some of the articles on specific hot rodders and or, you know, cars in general, and I'm wondering, who's reading it now? Aren't we all dying, essentially, hot rod and motorheads? I mean, honestly, what's the demographic of your average muscle car and or hot rod enthusiasts?
I think it's getting a little older, although there are younger people that are into it, especially the traditional hot rod stuff has come on mm-hmm. really strong, and younger people have really gotten into it. The Japanese are hugely into it.
Right.
Motorcycle stuff is still pretty strong.
But the industry is dying as a whole for motorcycles, right?
You know, it's getting older. And I think actually one of the best indicators of this is the fact that there even is such a thing as an autonomous car. I mean, people have gotten to the point where they're so unenchanted by travel and that they will text while they are driving because they are so bored.
Right.
You know, at the turn of the century when cars came in, the whole experience of traveling through space, of speed, it's almost unimaginable to people now because we're so used to it. But at the time, it was just hugely romantic. People with mm-hmm. thousands and thousands of people would show up
right.
for a race at a horse track mm-hmm. at their county fair. I mean,
family weekend drives, you could put the windshield
people,
down.
Yeah,
right?
Sunday they would go to mm-hmm. church, they would like yep. to go for a drive, they would go for a drive all afternoon. It's almost unimaginable. Inconceivable to people now that how popular and romantic the car was.
Right. I feel that way on a motorcycle. You know, one of my favorite things when I'm riding a bike and I feel like an idiot and or a kid at the same time is I like to look at the ground. You know, I like to drag my feet sometimes
watch
at high speeds.
Just,
yeah, because you're so close. It's such a visceral feeling when you're on a bike. I mean, you're right there. You're exposed to the elements. You look at the ground going past you at such a high speed. You know, maybe drag that foot a little bit at about 60 just for a second on the freeway. I mean, it's an exhilarating thing. It just, for me, again, it's such a soothing, wonderful thing. Hop on the freeway, go through the gears. I love it.
Well, it's fun. It's very thrilling. Speed is something that's
it's intoxicating.
Everybody enjoys speed, even babies. Babies yes. are not scared by speed. Babies
right.
love speed.
Yes.
The sensation of traveling at speed.
Right.
You know, look at how they sell cars now. They don't sell cars by the virtue of the car, like this is a well-made car, or this is a well-designed car, or right. They sell cars now by how it makes you feel or how you will look to your friends driving this car.
Right.
Or it just completely nonsensical, abstract concepts that have nothing to do with the car or...
Well, they're selling a lifestyle. Funny thing about new cars, though, I don't know if you agree, but they're so fast. People are so disinterested in driving them, and yet they are shockingly fast. I mean,
cars are much better, much more proficient, much more capable than they ever were.
I have a minivan, a new minivan, and I kind of have joked with people with older hot rods, you know, semi-stock, that I would race them in a quarter mile for pink slips in my minivan, because it is just ridiculous what that fuel-injected six-cylinder engine will put out. It's shocking. Oh,
yeah. It's crazy. I worked on vintage Italian sports cars for years, and everyone's always on. The biggest cliche in Italian cars is passion.
Yes.
They're so passionate. They're passion, this, passion, that, blah, blah, blah. I would, when people got too snippy with me, I would tell them, you know what? My wife's Honda Accord will smoke this car. Easily.
And I'm going to get really bitter here because I just sold my Ducati. There was a lot of passion to that when it ran. That Italian passion is wonderful when it's actually functional. However, that's a separate story. It's very upsetting
to
me.
They're really delightful. They're fast. And, you know, Italians are very stylish. You know, clothes, cars, design, all of that is mixed up in the Italian mind. And
well, I will say they performed too. I mean, it was a you know, probably the best performing motorcycle I've ever owned.
Oh, Shocking. They do what they do. They do it really well. They're not often the most comfortable things, but they do what they do.
Probably really, more reliable than
really
than
well
most people know. Also, what about electric and hybrid cars or diesels? Any interest in doing features on those? I mean, I remember
I haven't had a huge amount of experience with them. I more with diesels. I actually just started driving a Tesla recently, which is, I have very mixed feelings about Elon Musk as a person and his companies and supporting him in any way.
Sure.
I don't think the car is very stylish. I mean, it is and it isn't. It's hugely fast,
right?
And really, really quick. It'll probably run away from most high-performance cars.
Right, I've heard they're pretty amazing off the line.
It's amazing, but it's a whole other thing. I mean, how you drive it, how you conceptualize it as a driver, is much, much different from driving a gasoline-powered car.
Right.
I'm open to it. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think there are situations in which it probably is not appropriate. I have friends with ranches out in Nevada, out in the sticks, and I'm not sure how an electric autonomous car is going to really work in that environment.
Right. We haven't made the switch to electric simply. We have, I have three kids, and we are road warriors. You know, we spend a lot of time taking them places, and a lot of times it's, say, like out on the coast in some pretty desolate areas. And I know the battery life have gotten better and they're more reliable, but it worries me to think of, you know, having my entire family with me and having, you know, 10% charge and no reliable charging station.
Yeah. And I mean, and maybe I'm coming at this from a very old fashioned standpoint, but you know, if I take my hot rod out or one of my 60s cars out and I have a problem, I can fix it. If there's a problem with the Tesla, well, that's the end of it. I have no idea.
Right.
And in fact, I think they tell you don't mess around with it. It'll shock you to death.
That sounds right.
So, I don't know. But I mean, the driving experience is nice. It's interesting. It's a super clean design on the inside. It's, you know, it costs about $15 at a supercharger to charge it up to 300 miles of range, which is,
it's not bad.
A lot cheaper than filling up a tank of gas.
Particularly now. Yes, it is.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't intrinsically think that one is better than the other. It's just, You know, the electric car is not a new idea. There,
right.
there were electric cars before the turn of the 19th century, before mm-hmm. the turn of the 20th century. I mean, this is not a new idea in any way.
Right.
Almost nothing in the automotive world is new.
It's just battery capacity.
Yeah, it's materials.
Up, right?
The materials are more advanced now mm-hmm. than they were then, but none of this is new.
Right.
Elon Musk didn't think any of this stuff up.
No.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're an engineer or you're an engineering type or you're, the people that are into vintage cars, hot rods, sports cars, that type of thing, I think you'll find that in many cases, these people are also either active or slightly unknowing historians. I mean, you have to be into the romance of this and the mechanics of it and the aesthetics of it are really important, and they tie into, that's all tied up in driving a vintage car.
Right.
You know, and there are issues of class, and there are all different kinds of issues that are tied up in these things. So, it's, if you just want transportation, you know, then yeah, whatever, you know, whatever works. It's, yeah. I think of it in terms of the difference between a film camera and a digital camera.
Sure. My hot roddy / boy racer friends, they tell me I drive wash machines. You know, I've got two Toyotas. They're exceedingly, you know, reliable, functional transportation from point A to B. They're not that sexy, but, you know, they get the job done.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you'll read articles about that, and people will complain about, oh, well, that, you know, the difference between like a Ducati sports touring bike and a Honda sports touring bike. People will, well, the Honda's boring and it's not very inspiring. And well, you know what? It's going to run for years.
Right.
You're going to get where you're going.
Yes.
It's going to be inexpensive to fix.
Right.
And it's neither more nor less inspiring or whatever than the Italian bike.
Right.
It's just that the Italian bike makes you look more sophisticated to your friends.
Right. Yeah, yeah, so, yeah. There's the Italian allure there.
And plus
yeah.
there's a classism to it. You know, in order to have that, people assume, oh, well, he must have more money or he must be higher class or more sophisticated in some way, which is just hogwash.
I know. Yeah, it's funny so, you say that. When I got my Ducati, I went to a local barber shop and went in and the woman who was cutting my hair was like, oh, wow, you rode in on a Ducati? And I was like, oh, easy, easy. It's used, you know, it's under 10 grand. It's take it easy. But it was surprising to me, like, her reaction.
Yeah, but think of what they've done. I mean, why is that? Because Ducati has sold this image.
Sure.
And it's, you know, and they are beautiful. And they sound neat. And they are fast as hell.
Yep.
So, you know, it's a triumph of marketing.
Mm-hmm. Well, they sell a lifestyle. Again, it's like, what, Phil Knight? Remember his famous quote?
Yeah.
He's not selling shoes. He's selling a lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
Ducati does a great, great idea.
Yeah, it's a fashion accessory.
So let's move on to lifestyle. Let's talk a little bit about your photography. And speaking of lifestyle, I was doing a little research on photography and that Leica, right? Is it Leica? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, yeah.
What is going on with that? I've been hearing about that lens for so long, and it makes me think of, the DVX 100 and 100B in indie filmmaking. There was this huge cult following over that camera, even when it was totally outdated technology. People just love that particular camera. What is it about the Leica?
Well, I mean, this comes back at this point. It really is a fashion accessory. It's really analogous to Swiss watches.
Mm-hmm.
The Leica, I don't know if anybody knows, Leica is a 35mm camera. They did not invent the 35mm camera, but they became known for the quality of their cameras. They were made by a company called Ernst Lights. In Wetzlar, Germany, and they were invented by a guy named Oscar Barnack and before the First World War, about 1914. But after the First World War, they were the first really good miniature camera, and Lights made fantastic optics. And they invented a camera that used 35mm film stock. It was actually not invented originally as a camera. It was invented as a way to test your exposures before you shot a whole bunch of film.
Huh.
And they realized fairly quickly, like, oh, we could enlarge these images, and this is a good miniature camera. At the time, it was a miniature camera.
Right.
So
when you say miniature, what are we, like, spy camera are we talking? Or?
No, but at the time, a professional camera was a 4x5 or an 8x10. It's a big camera.
Right, right.
So this is a camera that's small enough to put in your pocket.
Okay, right.
And have, you know, 40 exposures instead of carry around 5 exposures or
right,
whatever.
Right.
So Leica has a long history, and some mm-hmm. of the very most famous photographs ever taken were taken with Leica. Some of the very best journalist photographers, guys like Cartier-Bresson or Robert Capa or, you know, Larry Burroughs, or, you know, various people have used Leica, and it's a byword for quality. And they're, you know, it's like many German things. The quality is incredible. They're fantastic. They're not always perfect, but it's been hugely, hugely reliable cameras, and they've become incredibly collectible. The Chinese especially have just gone crazy on them. The Japanese have gone yeah. crazy on them, and it's driven the prices up hugely. One of the very first Leicas ever made was just sold, I want to say, $14 million.
What? Seriously?
Just recently, yeah. And I have several of them. I have five or six of them, 50s models up okay. to 70s models. I used one early on in my photography career. I switched to Nikons when I started doing skateboard photography.
Is that for the lens speed?
Well, they had motor drives, and mm-hmm. Different things. Leica for years was a camera that's a style of a camera called a rangefinder, where you don't actually look through the lens. It's a way of shooting photos that's a little bit different mm-hmm. than the way we've come to use cameras, the 35mm SLR, where you look through the lens. Is in many ways a much easier camera to use as a professional. They're loud and tend to be pretty big.
Right.
The Leica is small and quiet. And so in many situations, it's a really good camera to use. It can be used quite quickly if you know how to use one. Mm-hmm. But it's a situation that's very similar to Swiss watches. You know, at one time a Swiss watch was, you know, that was what people got. That was right. what was available. There were good American watches, there were good English watches, but the Swiss made an industry of it, and you could buy
sure.
a Rolex relatively inexpensively.
Right.
You could buy, there were a number of Swiss watches that you could buy, and you could buy cheap Swiss watches.
Right.
But
not anymore.
Yeah, when the electric watch came in, it just about killed the Swiss watch industry, and they realized we cannot compete in the consumer market. We have to sell our product as a luxury product.
Right.
It has to be a lifestyle luxury product, and we must jack the price up, and
right.
we must. And it is literally a case of perceived value.
Right.
You know, if
it's
you,
obscene. Did you see yeah. Steve McQueen's one of his Rolexes?
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Sold, was like $28 million or something. Wasn't it up there? It was,
you know,
insanity.
It's ridiculous. It makes no sense. Some of this stuff just makes no sense. I mean, a Rolex is no better a watch than a vintage Seiko or
right.
any of these other watches. If you look at a Heuer Monaco, mm-hmm. which is a very famous chronograph,
right.
Almost exactly the same as a Rolex Daytona.
Mm-hmm.
Heuer Monaco, you could pick a great one up for $5,000 to $10,000, no problem. Good luck getting a Rolex Daytona is going to be $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, right. $60,000 for a watch that does exactly the same thing. And
tells
frankly, is a boring looking watch
right.
compared to a Heuer Monaco.
And those are obscene sums.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, that's
just idiotic.
More than your average American
and
is making
Rolex doesn't
per
even
year.
Make the movements.
Right.
They're made by Valjoux or
really?
Other, you know, Rolex makes the case and sells you the lifestyle.
Huh.
So,
I did not know that.
You know, it's kind of become the same thing with a Leica. Like the camera world, there are so many great cameras, and there were great Japanese cameras
right.
that are available that are the exact same thing as a Leica, except they're not valued as much as a Leica.
Right.
Because they're not a Leica.
A Leica, yeah.
But they do exactly the same thing, and in some cases have much better lenses than the Leica.
Right.
You know, a Canon P or a Nikon S4 or an S3. The lenses are just as good. The camera body does exactly the same thing that a Leica M3 does.
Right.
But you could buy a Canon P for $200, and you could buy a 50mm 1.4 for $300. An M3, a good M3, is going to cost you $1,500 to $3,000, and a Summicron, a basic Summicron F2, is going to cost you another couple thousand bucks. You know, so
which makes me think it would be interesting if you could do a you know, kind of a survey on amateur and or more trendy, trend-oriented photographers and really hardcore photographers and see what cameras they're using. You know, you would almost think, based on what you're saying, that the more hardcore professional would be using the more efficient Japanese cameras, you know, the trendier or you know, kind of a hobbyist would be with the Leicas.
I know guys, I have good friends of mine who are professional photographers, who are professional news photographers and have always used Leicas.
Okay.
There's nothing against them. They're fantastically reliable. The lenses are good. They just happen to be really expensive.
Right.
If you go into a situation where you run into a bunch of press corps photographers, they're going to be using Canon or Nikon SLR, digital SLRs.
Right.
They're just super reliable, super fixable. They're way less money. They're the industry standard. Right. There's just no reason to spend four or five times as much money.
Right.
And despite the fact that Leica guys will swear up and down that they're the best camera ever made and no Nikon or Canon could ever compare, blah, 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 and that's total BS.
Right.
The camera is just a tool. It's no different than a hammer.
Right.
The actual photographer is your eye and what you know and what you've read and what you've looked at and the art you've looked at and all of these things. That's what makes a photographer. The camera is just a tool.
Right. Which makes me want to ask you, you know, photography right now seems to be in like this frenzy as far as wedding photographers, the family photographers. You know, I find they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. There's a million photographers out there claiming to be professionals. And then there's a million people using their services. I know we actually use a very good photographer, but suddenly we're doing family photos like six times a year, eight times a year.
Well,
we're doing a Royal Tenenbaum shoot next week. I mean, it's crazy to me.
Yeah, but that's because that's what you want to do. It's not so much the photographer imposing themselves on you.
But what I'm saying is if you go on, say, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, you know, there are an awful lot of people selling their services as a quote unquote photographer. But I think what makes good, you know, good photographer, kind of like what makes a lot of good artists, is you have to have something internal. You have to have an eye. You have to have a vision, a creative vision, right? Because the shot setup is one of the most important things, isn't it? I mean, you can do a lot in post, you can do a lot in editing, Photoshop, and all the different programs, but they're nothing, right, without a good vision for the shot.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Somebody that's a good photographer, if you look at the work of a good professional photographer, like my friend Soroyan Humphrey that I mentioned, mm-hmm. my friend Donald Satterley, these are guys that have been professional photographers for years, and you and I could go shoot the same, we could all go shoot the same thing, and I guarantee you that what they turn out, you're going to be like, okay, that's way better than what I took.
Right, right.
And it's because they have a good eye and they've educated themselves and they understand design mm-hmm. and they've looked at a lot of art and they looked at a lot of photographs and they're passionate about it. You know, there, and it's like anything else in the world, there are people that are natural at it and there are people that are grind at it. I'm more of a grinder. I study actively. I look at a lot of photography. I study photography. I just grind and grind and grind.
Right.
At it.
Case in point, you know, I think I told you a few months ago, I bought a Sony A7S3 and I had that for about 6 months. And that is a really good camera. And just about everything I took with it was garbage. Absolute garbage. I mean, the quality of the photo itself was decent, but the actual...
There's probably a few tricks that you could have learned.
Maybe
somebody could have showed you that would make a huge difference in what you did. And it's just because you didn't know to do that.
Right. But the actual content, you know, what I was taking photos of was really uninteresting. I thought it looked good.
Well, there's that.
Yeah, the quality of the photo. That. Yeah, the quality of the actual, you know, the photo, the digital photo itself was superb from the camera.
Sure.
But the actual content was garbage, even though, again, I thought it was gonna make a cool photo, and I take it and I show it to a few people and they're like, it's not so great. And again, that, you know, I don't have a great vision. I wouldn't say I'm a visually creative person.
Well, and that's, you know, I mean, that's totally understandable. You have other skills, things that you've applied yourself to. So, you know.
What do you think about, sorry, what do you think about that whole, I always butcher the word, but the boudoir, you know, all the new.
Bokeh.
Yeah. No, you know, the, it always looks like it's a precursor to their OnlyFans page. Oh. But there are an awful lot.
I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
All the old-timey slash semi-pornographic photos that every man and woman seems
boudoir?
To be doing. Yeah, boudoir.
Well, that's always been popular.
It has, but now it's like, it's all the rage, and men are doing it now, too. I heard there's a photographer up in Roseville who specializes in men, and it's, I don't know what to make of it, although I do know...
There are
know,
a lot of people that specialize yeah, yeah. in men.
This is true. I do know it's been kind of a cool movement as far as, you know, body imagery, and a lot of people pushing it forward is how any man, woman can feel comfortable in their skin and sexy, right?
I don't have anything bad to say about it. If people can find something that makes them feel good about themselves, awesome. Keep going.
Right.
I don't know. These are just trends. You were talking about different photographers doing family photography or mm-hmm. different. These are just cultural trends, things that people get into, they see on social media, they're like, wow, that's neat, I want to do that, I'm going to try that. You know, it's just, I actually makes me feel good because it means there are jobs for photographers. And
right.
Photography, especially with the advent of the cell phone, has photographs have become worthless. I mean, you used to be able to sell in the golden age of the newspaper or the magazine, you know, a photographer could make a really good living
right.
as a photographer. Yes. And, but... with the advent of the cell phone and popular and digital photography, photography has become very worth very little.
Right.
So I'm for anything that means that a professional photographer can make a career and find a place for himself or herself. Yeah,
that's tough.
If
right
people
now,
are
right?
into that, I'm yeah, great.
It is tough, I would think, to be a photographer right now because again, with so many options out there, I mean, what allows somebody to be you know, a push to the front of the pack and actually become a, you know, professional, quote unquote, and make money off
you
it,
you have
right?
to have an eye and you have to have a head for business and you have to be willing to put yourself out there and ask for money.
Right. And I think maybe a good agent or promoter, you know, connections. Because if yeah, you can be the greatest photographer out there, but if people aren't seeing your work, right, you're not going
to
go anywhere.
Well, there are ways to promote yourself. And that's sort of the digital era. You know, you...
But would you say a lot of artists are good at self-promotion?
No.
It's not usually their forte, no. is it?
No,
right?
They're not. A lot of artists are not good at self-promotion, and that's why they don't get ahead.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole separate episode, isn't it, on artists, agents, promoters, talent
well,
managers?
Well, I just think a lot of people don't... I just think a lot of people either get in their own way, or mm-hmm. they, you know, as a lot of creative people... It's not uncommon for people to self-sabotage for their doubts or their worries or things like that. You know, and oftentimes when you look at people that are successful, they're artistic, they were able to push past that doubt and just go in and ask for the sale.
Right.
Go in and ask for the sale. And they, you know, some people are super confident and they're willing to march into the newspaper and go, hey, I'm a great writer and I want to work for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going anywhere until you hire me.
Right.
And some people are like, well, I don't know. They might not. I don't know.
Well, it's something to put yourself out there, isn't it?
You know, it's something that people that are creative, they have to work with in mm-hmm. their own head and get over. And, you yeah. know, creative people are different. You know, they're different. They have different skills. They have different.
Right.
Different personalities, and sometimes it comes together in one person, and sometimes it doesn't.
Right. I mean, the rejection can be hard. I get it. And again, you have to, you know, you're putting, I think, as an artist, sometimes the art's so personal to you that when you put it out there and there's criticism, you feel like they're saying, hey, you're a bad person. Like, if they don't like your photography, you're reading it as, Mike, you're a bad human being. I hate you. Right.
Yeah, no, I only take that when people tell me that.
Right, right.
but if you don't like what I do, whatever. That's yeah.
But
you
you're
know.
Doing it. You know, when I started doing this podcast, I've just done two episodes, but it's amazing to me how many people brushed it off. They said, oh, it's so easy. I could do my own podcast. And I said,
well, I think you've found out it's not so easy.
It's not so easy. And I asked them, why don't you do it? Well, I have. And I'm like, yeah, it's not. You know, I suppose in some ways it is easy, but you have to do it and then put it out there.
You have to have something to say.
Right, yeah. Well, they don't.
You have
they
to
all
have content.
Don't. I don't know about that, but, you know, you have to put it out there, right? You have to be willing to
absolutely.
Put it
you're
out there.
You're not going to get anywhere if you don't put it out.
Mm-mm. So speaking of Put It Out, let's move on to your band, Mike Blanchard and the Californias.
Yeah.
I was just jamming your new album today. So that came out in 2019, right? Dark Secrets?
Yep.
Okay, but you've been playing for a long time, correct?
Yeah, since I was a kid. My dad used to make guitars and musical instruments. My grandfather had a band. He was a harmonica player. And we were always musicians around our house or artists or whatever. I actually started singing in the church choir.
Oh, you did not, really?
And we used to tour. We toured Canada. Uh-huh. We toured the Western United States. And
shouldn't you be a jazz singer then? It
was quite an experience. Uh-huh. It was a lot of fun.
That is awesome.
But I actually got into it for more. I got into it because all the guys that I knew that had really great girlfriends were guitar players.
Right. So you're the lead singer and then what, lead guitar or rhythm guitar for the band?
No, we have a fantastic lead guitar player, Roger Kunkel, who was in the band Thin White Rope.
Okay.
He's just phenomenal.
Right. I mean, I've seen you guys perform. I wouldn't know lead from rhythm. You know.
No, I write songs and sing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How long has this particular band been together?
Oh, geez. More than 10 years, maybe 15 years.
Okay. That's substantial.
Before that, I had a band called the Tattooed Love Dogs, and we toured, and
what style was that?
It was what they used to call twang rock. That was sort of, it was before they had Americana, and right. It was very confusing. I remember we had a meeting at Mercury Records, and they were really interested in us, and they were like, well, we don't know. Are you guys a country band or are you guys a rock band? We don't know what pigeonhole to put you in.
It's funny you say that because Apple has you as country.
Yeah.
And I look at you guys and I'm thinking old timey, rockabilly, folk rock.
Yeah, it's what they call Americana.
Yeah, Americana, right, right. But they've got you as country, which is cool. I was just surprised.
Yeah, it's we just play what we like and what we write. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... We could play bluegrass. We could play a bunch of bluegrass songs or honky-tonk, old honky-tonk songs. Or we could play sets of original music. Or we could play, you know, what would be folk music. Or
right.
We just... I don't like bands that all sound the same. Every song on the record sounds the same.
Right.
I'm just really not interested in that. We have much broader musical tastes. So we take things from here and there and... You know, that's what we do. The guys in the band are super professionals. They've all come from really high-end professional bands. They could play with any act in the country, no problem.
Right.
But they all are, at this point in their life, we're all in our 50s or 60s, and the guys, they don't want to tour because they have jobs, good jobs, and they make good money, and they don't want to go on tour, and they don't want to, you know. So we play between San Francisco and Reno and some gigs to the north, some gigs to the south. Mm-hmm. But we kind of stick in our own area at this point. We make good money. We have a very good reputation, I think, and very professional band. And so, you know.
Is that your other album was Gringo in 2013, right? So that's a substantial gap between albums.
Yeah, it is a long gap. The band totally changed in that interval. We also produced a television show. I produced a television show called The Rabbit's Foot Ramble. It's on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
There are 8 or 9 episodes of it on YouTube. So we worked on that in between.
Right.
You know, and the band, the personnel in the band changed dramatically. The sound of the band changed dramatically. So,
because your wife recently left the band, right? She's on your last album and was a pretty integral part of the band, right?
Yeah. She was a huge part of the band. Mm-hmm. The band actually started out we would get together and barbecue on Friday nights and have friends come over and we'd play music. And then... It got good enough that we were like, well, let's do a gig or two. We got hired to do some gigs, and then one thing led to another, and the next thing you know, you're playing 100 times a year.
Right. Right. It's a grind, right?
So, yeah, no, my wife's not in the band anymore. She's a painter, and she really wanted to devote herself more fully to painting. And so she still gets up and does songs, and she's been badgering me lately to... put together a duo act and go out and do some duos. It's, so we'll see. She's a fantastic singer since she was a kid.
Yeah, she's great.
So,
You know, kind of like the whiskey resurgence. It's interesting to me that your type of music's coming back. I mean, you know, I remember, what is it, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
You know, that really catapulted kind of that old timey and or not psychobilly or rockabilly, but folk rock. Right, kind of that whole genre, it kind of pushed it back into the mainstream, and it seems to be sticking this time, right? Because it's gone up and down. I mean, we had the 60s, of course, right? We had Neil Young and Joan Baez.
Yeah, but
and,
you know, now you have artists like Chris Gaines or Lucas Nelson, that's, you know, country music has splintered into bro country.
And
more traditional country music. You know, the radio business went with bro country, and then the traditional country kind of went more underground, but now it's coming back really strongly, partly in thanks to, you know, things like YouTube or social media or things like that. And it's I feel that it's more authentic, a more authentic kind of music. Country music, commercial country, bro country is basically pop music with hats and fiddles,
right,
as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And there are certain cliche themes, you know.
Oh, yeah. What do they
I'm an
say?
Idiot, and my girlfriend's dad hates me, and I got a big truck, but I don't care.
Right. Isn't that if you play a country western music backwards, right? Your truck starts running, your wife comes back, and your dog's alive.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, there are people that are very serious about it and have built serious careers, and I'm reluctant to be too critical of people that have made a career out of an artistic venture. It's just not what I'm into.
Sure. I've been listening to a lot of the YouTube people I've found. Like, have you heard of Chris Rodriguez? And then he's got the Abby the Spoon Woman, who's this world aficionado on spoons. So you got to check it out. It's amazing. And I love, it actually makes me think of like 80s punk rock. It's so raw. And so just down to earth, you know, their videos are usually on the porch of his house or a random trailer. You know, there's a dog occasionally strolling through, and it's not choreographed. They're not actually letting the dog out to try and make it look,
it's just the way,
you know,
they
hardcore.
Are.
Yeah, it's just the way they are. I mean,
it's
the music.
Like Dancing Outlaw. Or,
yeah, right, right. It's amazing, and it's amazing music too. You know,
well, there's fantastic. Yeah, there's a lot of fantastic music. I mean, the Carolina Chocolate Drops and all different kinds of. People that are doing Rhiannon Giddens, people that are doing traditional music and really making it relevant for more modern times. And I think that's just fantastic. I love it. I love all different kinds of music. I'm a huge ELO freak. I actually like the Bee Gees.
I like some of the Bee Gees. And coming out of like the skating scene, right? Punk rock. I mean, you ever get into that?
Oh, yeah. Right? It was sort of a little bit after my generation, but yeah, I mean, I love the Ramones, and I love X and
7 Seconds, Agent
Orange. I love Kevin Seconds, is a good friend of mine. He's a local guy here from Sacramento.
Love
you should have
seconds.
Him on your podcast.
I would love to. I didn't know he was local. I saw him in San Jose, ended in a huge melee, you know, total riot in the crowd.
No, Kevin's an fantastic. Amazing songwriter, and you know, he's a good friend. And he's got some really neat artistic ventures going on. I highly recommend you look him up on Spotify or Instagram. He's just an amazing guy.
So do you draw all your influences from just every type of music? You don't pigeonhole yourself, right?
Absolutely. You know, I love all different kinds of music. Yeah.
What do you think about the music industry right now? I mean, in general, you mentioned a little bit, but to me, right? I mean, it's like two sides. You have the full studio created. I mean, remember back in the day when the Backstreet Boys, you know, a couple different bands, they were good, but they were created, right? You know, there were auditions, they brought them in, they were looking for a certain look and a certain sound, and then the studio gave them their song, their music, voila, we've got a hit single, right?
Yeah, but that's always been the case. I mean, that was the Motown formula.
Yeah,
that was
so.
The Brill Building formula. That's always been the case. That's just part of the industry. They producers build something and put it together and control it and put it all together.
But it seems much more prolific now.
I don't know if it is or not. I mean, the thing about the computer and the internet, and we have this amazing technology that we're using to make this podcast. Mm-hmm. That, you know, people say the computer and the internet killed the music industry, and it really didn't. It just changed it. Mm-hmm. So instead of there being a record company, you're the record company.
Right.
you know, as an example, the last time I was in Nashville, we have a friend who is one of Jack White's managers, and he invited us to come, gave us a tour of Third Bend Records. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to see, because it was really clear that here's this artist who has made himself his own record company. He sells, produces and sells all the merchandising and swag. Mm-hmm. He produces records. The artist is the record company.
Right.
You have every opportunity to do everything that Capitol Records could ever do for you
right.
on your computer.
Right.
Right now. All you have to do is sit down with your guitar and write a song and play it.
Right.
And have the balls and the stick-to-itiveness
right.
to do it.
Right. The persistence.
Yeah. And I understand that it takes money, mm-hmm. but you can push your way through these things.
Right.
So on the one hand, sorry that I couldn't go down to LA and try and talk the guys at Capitol Records into giving me a record deal, because that's sort of lets me out of having to do a bunch of it.
Right.
But, right. you know, but I can, you know, do a bunch of gigs for a couple months and save up enough money to go into the studio and make a record.
Right. Which is super cool. And with what I said about the industry, I actually love the music industry today, or love the music scene today, because of the computer. I think you said earlier, a camera's a tool. You know, a computer's a tool. You want to go on and look at just a bunch of standard, you know, I don't want to say boring, but corporate produced music, you can do that. But if you search around, the cool thing about the interweb is you can go on and find people in like Hungary, you know, Czechoslovakia. I mean, you can find musicians yeah. from all over the world that you yeah. never would have had access yeah. to before. I mean, there's yeah. so much good music out there at the click of a button, if you just look, right? I mean, it's amazing.
There's all kinds of people. I mean, a really interesting thing that my wife and I have gotten into is there's a thing on YouTube called Playing for Change. Mm-hmm. And they're covering songs that you probably heard, really well-known songs, but it's musicians from all over the world and people that I've never heard of. They're famous people
right.
as well, people that you have heard of, but they're also, you know, a ton of people that you never heard of that are
right.
incredible. You know, and another example is I'll look at the lineup for, I don't know, some music festival, you know, Coachella or whatever. And you know, 80% of who's on the bill is somebody I never heard of. I have no idea who these people are. Yeah,
but you can preview it and see whether it's worth actually going to the show.
They
right?
don't have a record deal. Some of them don't have a record deal. They only
right.
play the festival circuit and they sell however many million downloads mm-hmm. off Spotify or whatever. They don't really have a record deal.
Right.
I mean, they might now that they've sold however many sure. million downloads off Spotify, but
right.
But yeah, these are predominantly people that made their name and made mm-hmm. their fame and fortune online by marketing themselves online.
Which is very cool.
I mean,
makes me think of free surfers. You know, it used to be right in the 80s when surfing really started booming. You know, it started to become this corporate monster, and you had to have a sponsor, and you had to surf the contest, and you had to do a certain tricks in the contest to score high, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then suddenly free surfing came out, right? The Donovan Frankenritter, I was butchering his last name.
I'm just going to go surfing, screw that.
Right, well, because you had the video camera and the internet, and you could go and surf these amazing spots, get this unbelievable footage and put it out there for the world to see. And it was like, hey, people are really interested in this, and you can make a living at it. It's extremely cool. Not to say the contests aren't too. I mean, the contests are still amazing, but it's nice that it added, you know, a different, avenue for people to pursue. And again, online for music. I mean, really, any art online is so cool because you can just find it, again, from all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, online's neat, but I mean, it's not a patch to standing in front of a good painting.
Well,
or going and standing in front of a band and seeing them play or
very
whatever.
True.
But
very true. Live shows, you know, there's always something to live shows.
Well, there's an interchange of energy that you don't really get
right.
online, but
speaking of live shows, who would you say, who comes to your shows? Do you get a good mix of like all different types of people?
Yeah, actually, yeah, we do. We have young people and older people.
Because people like to pigeonhole country music, right, of a certain type of fan.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true. I think it appeals to...
I think if you just have good melody and good mm-hmm. rhythm, people respond to it. I was at a beer festival on Saturday and there were three bands. One of them was a three-piece instrumental band. very kind of funk, funk rock, jam, jazz. And then there was another band that was playing bluegrass crossed with klezmer. And then there was a third act, which was a solo act.
What's klezmer?
Klezmer is a kind of traditional, I don't know if Jewish is the right term. Huh. Oftentimes in Yiddish, oftentimes clarinet, very rhythmic, really cool music, very jazz, very like Scott Joplin in some respects, that type of music. But it's a whole other genre of music. It was super popular within the Jewish community at the turn of the century.
Interesting.
Fantastic players in all, playing all different kinds of instruments, but it's very common to have a clarinet player or a mandolin player. So anyway, but the crowd responded really strongly to all three of these bands, even though they could not have been more different stylistically, but they all played, they were very well, very good players, and they all had great rhythm.
Right.
And that always helps because it makes people dance. That's a very physical thing. Rhythm is a physical thing. It's almost like, you know, hitting your funny bone or, you know, whatever. You can't help yourself. If rhythm hits people, the bass, the drums, is a very physical thing, and it creates an inescapable physical reaction of dopamine, and it hits pleasure centers in your brain in ways that are completely inescapable. You cannot control. It's an autonomic response.
Well, I love when you're at a supermarket or wherever you're at in a public place, and kind of a funky song comes on, and you actually subconsciously start, you know, your head's moving, maybe your hip, and you look around, and there's always like two or three other people who have no idea they're doing it, but they're actually semi-dancing to the music. It's so great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that, though, with music, how long are you going to keep playing with the Californios? I mean, are you just going to play till you can't play anymore? I mean, where do you see it going?
No, music is a thing that can challenge you your whole life. You can play your whole life.
Right.
So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. The guys in the band play in different bands as well. Roger has a band called the Smoke Shovelers, which is fantastic. And Eric plays in a band called the Acme Soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And Vinny has a duo called the Hummingbirds. And Rob plays with the Loose Engines. So that all the guys have different things going on at different times. So, and I do solo shows sometimes, which is really fun.
That is a lot going on, Mike. I mean, I said that at the beginning of the show. You are
crazy.
Quite the Renaissance man.
Yeah, I never know how to tell people. People ask me what I do, and there's so many things that I hesitate to even say things. I'm somewhat embarrassed sometimes to say all the things I do because people find it hard to believe or in some ways suspicious.
Well, there used to be the old adage, a man who says he does a lot of things isn't really good at any of them. You know, they're always just kind of mediocre, but I think you're pretty damn good. It's just about everything I've seen you do.
There are people that are better than me, but I work really hard to be competent at what I do. I work really hard at it. But I view these things in somewhat different way maybe than some people. I strongly believe that all art is related. It doesn't matter whether you're a writer or you're a painter or you're a musician. All art is the result of one good idea. And whatever medium you work in is just a way to express that idea. And you master that medium so that it does not get in the way of your idea.
Right.
So if there used to be a thing, you know, where a well-educated person should be able to play music. You should be able to write.
Particularly piano.
You should be, all these things are part of a well-rounded person.
Right.
And that may be an old-fashioned viewpoint, but that's kind of the way that I look at it. I just pursue things that are interesting to me.
Right. If you had to par them down, you know, some catastrophic thing happened and you could only do one artistic thing, what would it be? Could you even answer that?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I would probably, I love painting and drawing. I do that a lot. Playing music is pretty fundamental. You know, I don't know. I would probably maybe play music, or I would probably, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. I've thought about that. Mm-hmm. I have thought about that.
Because at some point, you have to slow down, right? I mean, you have to start kind of...
You don't have to slow down.
Well, I mean, I slow down, but you got to, you know, maybe whittle down a few of those hobbies, right?
Yeah, no, that's a really good thing. I'm kind of at a point in my life where I'm getting rid of things or paring mm-hmm. things down or simplifying things. You know, there are always things that are really attractive. I could go in any one of the directions and just go in that direction, write or just paint or, you know, just whatever, play music or whatever.
Right.
I don't know.
All right.
I couldn't really give you a good answer on that.
Hey, not a problem. Yeah. Listen, we've covered a lot of ground here, Mike. I want to thank you for being here with us. It has been a pleasure. We are going to fade out here, if you don't mind, with my favorite song on the album, 99.
Oh, one of Vinny's songs. Awesome.
You can find more about Mike and his endeavors with a simple web search. Mike Blanchard and the Californios are on Apple Music. Their website is mikeblanchardandthecalifornios.com. Rust is at rustmag.com. Culture Mashup is produced, hosted, and created by me, your host, Bill Doyle. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. One day I took off alone. Looking for real stuff.
No other place in this country.